ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Kirsty Melville here with The History Listen. In Australia, we rightly treat our fallen war heroes with reverence and respect. Acts of remembrance are woven into our culture. But our experience of war is often different to other countries. During World War II, we lost many, mostly on foreign soil. So how do people in those countries remember Australians who made the ultimate sacrifice? Jack Dawson Green is one of those Australians. He was a Spitfire pilot shot down over the Netherlands when he was just 21. Producer James Viver has used military records, family letters, and fellow pilots' memoirs to recreate Jack's experience in the cockpit and to tell his story of being at war.
It's 1944, and Hitler is lashing out against England with a new kind of weapon that is killing thousands, the V1 and V2 flying bombs.
Evacuee should continue to stay out of London.
Once it was fired, you couldn't stop it. It was travelling at hundreds of miles an hour, and there was no warning of it.
We should be extremely foolish if we decided that the enemy's destruction of us has completely stopped.
The first thing that was known was the explosion when it hit the ground.
Half a million Londoners were bombed out during the Blitz and the flying bomb raids.
Pilots from all over the world flew missions to try and stop this Nazi attack. One of those was 21-year-old Jack Dawson Green.
The Spitfire is a beauty. What an aircraft. She's a joy to fly.
I don't think he would have had any fear. I really don't.
Went in the attack all by himself without any cover and flew straight into a four-barrel 20mm anti-aircraft gun, and that's what killed him.
Jack gave his life during World War II, but the story of his sacrifice lives on.
It's all part of their history class. They visit his grave and, you know, lay flowers and have a little service. And then, of course, they were given permission to look after the grave.
He befriended a few people long after he died, but still they're his friends.
Jack's story starts earlier in the 1940s in the Greens family home in Melbourne.
Where they lived in Camberwell, there are paddocks all around.
Margaret Bardwell is Jack's niece.
He used to lie in the long grass and wait for his sister to come past and give her a fright.
That sister was Margaret's mum.
I remember the house, it was always clean and tidy, and my grandmother always baked things.
Jack was a natural sportsman, playing hockey, AFL football and swimming. He was cheeky, outgoing and adventurous.
Because at 15 he ran away and joined the army. They eventually found him at a place called Summers on the Mornington Peninsula, where there was an army base, and he was the PT instructor. I think he might have been just thinking that he could do something for the world, help in some way if he joined the army.
Mum and Dad were none too happy when they found me. But what was I supposed to do? This war is all anyone talks about. They say it's our duty to serve, and I think that's right and proper. So what if I put my age up? Half the recruits had done the same, and their parents didn't come looking. The army suited me just fine. Now I've got to wait till I'm 18. Then Dad says I can join up with permission. Who knows where the war will be by then? I should like it to be over, of course. But I want to serve my country, like all the others.
The Royal Australian Air Force is training men to help win the war in the air. If you are between 18 and 32 years of age, you have the opportunity of joining the RAAF.
Jack waited out the years, and in August 42, aged 18, he joined the RAAF, training to be a pilot at Jerilderie in New South Wales.
Green, JD. On 27th May 1943, in aircraft A20538,
where his adventurous spirit got the better of him.
Flew at a height of not more than 50 feet, inverted, over civilian area. 28 days detention, forfeit of 28 days pay.
J Jack flew his Tiger Moth biplane along the main street of Jerilderie, 15 metres above the ground, upside down.
It could be a little bit of a terror, I believe.
Despite all this, on the 29th of July 1943, Jack earned his wings. Margaret has an old black and white photo of him taken on that day.
One of those portraits that they all had done. Oh, I love this photo. He's really smiling with his eyes, not his mouth. It brings him to life.
Just a week later, Jack left Australia to join the war, which of course meant leaving his family behind. Jack's mother and father and his sister Joyce were there to say goodbye.
I got to the station late, of course, feeling worse for wear, and probably half drunk from the send-off. Mum and Joyce, and they could tell I'd been at the drink. Joyce gave me the cold shoulder, as a matter of fact. "How could I do this to my mother?" she said. Called me a disgrace to the uniform, which I was still wearing from the night before. Still, there was no time for fuss. We said our goodbyes, a kiss for Joyce and Mum. Then it was on the train to Sydney, a chance to sleep it off.
She kissed him goodbye, my mother kissed him goodbye, and she said that years later, you know, she could still feel the coat scratching against her face. And that was the last time she spoke to him.
In October 1943, Jack arrived in a war-weary England. He and the other Australian pilots were sent to the coastal town of Brighton, south of London, to wait for further orders.
Can't wait to get up there and show those damned Jerrys what for. But waiting is the mission for now. There's hardly any people. 30,000 evacuated, they say. And then there's the beach. The army's buried mines right along the coast, so it's out of bounds to all and sundry. The Germans drop leftover bombs from the London raids here at Brighton. You can see the damage. Houses, bridges, even the cinema blown to pieces. Let's hope that's a difference that Melbourne's Brighton keeps over England's.
You are listening to a news broadcast from the ABC.
Hitler was about to launch a new type of weapon into those same skies above England. The V-1 and V-2 flying bombs, the so-called revenge weapons, were hugely damaging and were terrorising London.
More flying bombs inflicted damage and casualties in Britain on Thursday night and Friday.
Word is that Hitler's V-1s and V-2s are bombs that fly themselves. No pilot. They're being launched from Holland and giving Londoners another taste of the Blitz, even though D-Day has been and gone. That poor lot have been through it.
Goebbels added that the next month would show what little reason the British had for triumph. Germany would employ new weapons. Flying bomb was merely a beginning.
As 1944 turned into 1945, Jack had qualified and been posted to 603 City of Edinburgh Squadron, based during the war in Ludham on the east coast of England. A plan was hatched to try and stop the bombs before they were launched. It was called Operation Big Ben.
It's up to squadrons like ours to give the Nazis hell.
He would pilot modified Spitfires in a new and experimental style of flying. For a young pilot, this was the jackpot. The Spitfire was the most famous plane in the world. It had won the Battle of Britain and kept the Nazis out of England. And now Jack would be at the controls.
Ours are Mark 16s. The wings are clipped shorter so we can dive down as quick as you like and bomb our targets. Just flip her over, point the nose down, and it's 10,000 feet to 200 feet in a few seconds. A few of the other pilots have blacked out in the dive and come to just in time. But not me. There I was, thinking I'd be chasing German bombers. Instead, I'm doing the bombing.
For
for the British and certainly for the Spitfire pilots, it was something new and something that was quite testing. It required a lot of skill and a lot of courage to do it.
Bill Simpson is a historian and author. He's written extensively about Jack's squadron, 603 City of Edinburgh.
They would fly over the target and the pilot would watch over his shoulder to see the target appearing at the rear end of the wing. And once he saw that, he would flip over into the dive. They would drop the bombs at about 2,000 feet, 1,500 feet, diving at about 360 miles an hour. And then continue the dive to low level, maybe a couple of hundred feet. Once you got to the bottom of the dive and pulled out, the pilots and the aircraft were subject to high stress levels, about 5G, which is five times the force of gravity.
Fear was part of everyday life for Jack and the other pilots in 603 Squadron. But they had the ability to overcome it, even use it to their advantage.
A certain amount of fear will give you adrenaline so that you can deal with what you're trying to do. And for a lot of the pilots, I think that was the case. They were real characters. A lot of them, it was live for the moment and forget tomorrow. You never knew what was going to happen the next day, whether you might be the one that was going to be shot down or killed.
We're flying two or three times a day now, when the weather suits. There's always a carpet of flak, simply a matter of staying clear of it. Railway lines, factories, fuel dumps, all kinds of targets sent sky high with the bombs from our mighty Spits. After flying like that, we've got a job to match the thrill of it all while we're on the ground.
I fell in love with the airman who had big blue eyes.
There's always this sense of danger, but they all seem to be quite nonchalant about it. They have this carefree way of conducting themselves. I think it's quite marvellous. Many of them did have a twinkle in their eye. They were looking for the ladies and they were looking for the pubs and the beer. They were very lively young men. It would be true to say that they worked hard and played hard.
Jack settled into squadron life at 603.
The other day, we pushed one pilot's car on top of a bunker while he was up. His face was a picture when he landed. The Australians are thick as thieves, of course. We're in the same barracks hut, with just a potbelly stove stopping us from freezing stiff. The Pommy pilots say this winter puts others to shame. Off duty? We're trying the local pubs for size. And of course, we've all been getting to know the WAFs on station. There's a driver in the transport section named Corporal Connolly. Julie. Now there's two reasons for it to be my shout at the bar.
Oh, this is the photo of him in his flying gear.
Jack's niece, Margaret.
He was probably thinking to send a photo back home to show what they wore when they were in the plane with their big woolen lined boots, which they kept their papers in. Of course, their little flying helmets, big flying gloves. And this is another photo I love of him just standing there, and that must be his car. He traded his motorcycle in for the car. And eventually he crashed it. And he was all right, but the police were more interested in the pile of RAF blankets he had on the back seat. And he's a little bit of a devil.
In the first few months of 1945, 603 Squadron's part in Operation Big Ben was going well.
These are flights where they're trying to find things, they're trying to spot them. And so when they were doing these recces, as they called them, they were actually fighting patrols, if you like. They were looking for targets, and then when they found the targets, they would attack them. They did manage to attack the infrastructure that was supporting the V2s, so that was something. They must have prevented some of the launches. They also had the effect of giving moral courage to the population of the southeast of England who were under the V2s. They gave a lot of courage to the Dutch civilians because the sight of the Spitfires overhead gave them a boost.
March 17th, 1945. Clear weather meant more dive bombing attacks for 603 Squadron. Today's target was a railway junction where flying bombs were being transported. After successfully hitting their targets, 603 were heading back to a Belgian airfield to refuel and rearm. That's when Jack spotted a potential extra target.
Sir, I can see a German truck at 11 o'clock, heading towards the river.
Roger, well spotted. Could be a V2 transport. Let's do an orbit and take a look. Bearing 275 at 2,000 feet should do it. Stand down, White Company. Too close to the town, I'm afraid, Jack. Civilian risk, too great. God knows they've got enough to deal with.
There's the gun on the bridge!
Jack, White Leader to Jack. Heading to rendezvous point, please acknowledge.
I'm hit! I'm hit!
Jack had spotted the truck as a potential target, but he hadn't seen the anti-aircraft guns defending the bridge. His plane was hit, and he crash-landed. But after a mix-up in the orders, his fellow pilots didn't realize he was missing.
For somebody who went down behind enemy lines, there's nothing they can do to stop it or correct it. They would just continue on and hope that at some point they received the message from the Germans that he had survived.
Just 90 minutes later, the pilots were up flying again.
When a pilot was lost, it was felt by the others, but of course they had to put it behind them because they would be flying the next day and it may be that they would be the next one to go.
On the ground in Holland, in a little town called Barendrecht, locals had seen Jack Spitfire attack the bridge and watched his plane crash into the farmland.
When his body was lifted out of the cockpit, he was already dead.
Dutch military historian Hans Onderwater.
The nose of the aircraft was still warm. Some of the Germans from the anti-aircraft battery came there for souvenirs. They stole his flying boots and they took, of course, his Webley revolver and they kept his parachute because they wanted the silk for themselves. He was taken to the cemetery in his flying uniform, in his RAF blue, in his socks, so with no shoes on. The keeper of the cemetery went home and brought his undertaker shoes. He was decently buried with his shoes on.
Back in the squadron, nobody knew what happened to Jack beyond his last radio message. The RAF wrote to Jack's family.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Green, it is with deepest regret that I have to write to inform you that your son Jack is missing. On 17th March, he sighted a German transport and dived away to engage the enemy in the face of intense flak. Nothing more was seen of him, but the absence of any explosion gave us hopes of his having made a successful landing, and now being a prisoner of war. Squadron Leader T.C. Rigler, Ludham, 18th of March, 1945.
A wooden cross was put on Jack's grave, his name taken from his dog tags.
But there were no floral tributes allowed, and it was curfew. After 8 o'clock was curfew. So there was a 17-year-old young man, his name was Kok van Duin. Every night, when it was dark, he would crawl under the fence of the cemetery and bring flowers. The next morning, the Nazi police officers would come, remove the flowers. So this particular guy would go there again and again and again until in the end they gave up and left him.
The Van Duyns had taken Jack flowers. They knew Jack's name and that he crashed nearby, but that was about it. Just 3 weeks after Jack died, VE Day was celebrated and the world's biggest ever conflict came to a close. A friend from 603 Squadron, Colin Wheatley, wrote to Jack's family.
Dear Mrs. Green, I must confess that I am deeply moved by the fact that the authorities have given up Jack. I can't understand how Jack came to simply disappear without a trace. I had no better or more reliable friend than Jack. I was married in a uniform that Jack lent me. The war is over, but for chaps like myself who have made and lost friends, there can be nothing but bitterness towards a civilization that allowed war to eventuate. Mrs. Green, I would like you to accept, together with my sincere sympathy, my utmost respect to both you and Mr. Green for the fine lad you gave your country. Yours very sincerely, Colin Wheatley.
In the aftermath of the war, the Green family, like so many others, tried to find out what happened to Jack. How did he die? Where and how had his body been buried? Jack's niece, Margaret.
My grandparents were informed that he was missing. And then my grandfather, of course, was backwards and forwards to the Defence Department about his belongings and his car and everything.
Personal effects. Warrant Officer Green JD 419408, 6 March 1946. One kit bag.
And they did get a green trunk, which I've still got. The trunk where Uncle Jack sings came back in.
One RAF cap and badge. One bundle of photos. One wristwatch. One pilot's badge with linen strip.
But there wasn't much that they sent back.
RAAF Casualty Section, December 10th, 1946. Dear Sir, it is with deep regret that I have to inform you that the death of your son, Warrant Officer Jack Dawson Green, has now been presumed for official purposes. Following cessation of the hostilities in the European theatre, no further news of your son has been received by the Air Ministry.
In 1947, 2 years after he crashed, it was the Van Downs who wrote to Jack's family to say he was buried in Barendrecht.
And of course, my grandparents weren't well off, so they could never visited his grave. They always had this photo there, and his mother always, you'd catch her cuddling the photo and crying, but didn't say anything.
Dutch military historian Hans Onderwater has his own connection to the Second World War.
Collaborators who were dangerous, and he had to ride behind him on the bicycle, get his Webley out of his pocket, the Webley is a revolver, and then shoot him through the head.
His father was an assassin in the Dutch resistance.
And that was called in Holland to put him before the chair of God.
Hans didn't find out all this until after his father died. But it did spark an interest in the history of World War II at a local level, the experience of people in small towns all over the Netherlands. And as it happened, in the late 1970s, Hans moved to one of those small towns, Barendrecht, working at the municipal archives.
When I saw his grave and I thought, what the hell is an Australian doing here? I started to find out who Jack Dawson Green was. I talked to a farmer nearby who owns that land. And he said, whatever we planted, wheat, sugar beets, nothing wanted to grow. It was always an empty spot in my field because the ground also had been soiled. The Dutch Air Force had been digging the plane up because all bits and pieces were coming up and the farmer was complaining about it. So we knew exactly where he crashed.
Hans thought that some of Jack's relatives may still be alive, and he tried to track them down.
I remember it all started with an article in the local Camberwell paper. There was a lady that still lived in the street, a couple of doors down from where Jack's mother was. And she saw the article and she knew where my mum was. She got in touch with her and said, you know, someone's looking for you.
Hans had found Jack's sister Joyce. They spent a few years writing to one another, Hans sharing his research, allowing Jack's family to slowly piece together what happened.
Jack Dawson Green, by his death, connected us forever. I'm happy to have been able to give at least some comfort to his next of kin.
In 1982, Hans published his book on the local war history.
And through the royalties of my book, I was able to help them a little bit in the costs of their airfare. I mean, it's the least I can do.
In 1984, with a little help from Hans, Joyce and her husband Neil were finally able to go to the Netherlands and visit Jack's grave for the first time, almost 40 years after he died.
She took it very well, but it was hard. She was really sobbing. I can still see Neil putting his arm around Joyce, saying, "Leave it, dear, leave it, leave it." And then I took them to the site where he actually crashed. She stood at the place where the plane came down. It has mellowed the pain for Joyce.
Joyce and Margaret also met the Van Down family, who'd done so much to care for Jack's grave from 1945 onwards.
I remember whenever we took Joyce to Mrs. Van Down in the house where she lived, and the two ladies would be talking to each other, and they would be talking about knitting and making pancakes, but also about their memories of the Second World War, and they were very close.
I mean, what the Van Downs didn't put their lives in peril. There's no words to describe it. Really, gratitude isn't enough. Thank you isn't enough, so.
Joyce went on to visit her brother in Barendrecht every 5 years or so. Margaret went with her mum too to remember her Uncle Jack. Today in Barendrecht, there is a memorial at the local church and another at the place where Jack crashed. Margaret was there when they opened it.
And there's a photo of the children. Two of them sang Amazing Grace. And it was so cold and windy, and these two beautiful, clear voices just floating over the air. It was wonderful. And at the end of it, I was sobbing.
Like the people in Barendrecht, Margaret has never met her Uncle Jack. Even though Jack died before she was born, Margaret still feels a sense of loss.
I do, actually. I do. I always have. I sort of think, yeah, I think we would have had a relationship more so than any of my sisters. People say that I look like him. And my sister, elder sister, says I'm reincarnated because I love flying.
Flying is the greatest feeling a man can have. Just the wonder of it. My mind has never been clearer and calmer as it is up there. The sky is like a vast, noiseless blanket. The silence is a comfort. Mankind shouldn't be up in the skies by rights, but up there I've been. Sometimes I wish I could stay up there in the stillness of it all.
The Friendship Spitfire, with sound design by James and Simon Branthwaite. Jack was played by Brendan Hawke, with other roles played by PJ Williams and Emrys Cronin. The executive producer is Michelle Rayner. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I do hope you enjoyed this episode of The History Listen and that you can join me again next time. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.